Today's sponsor, Prudential, knows a lot about starting a second life. They know that 2 out of 5 new businesses are started by women who are also juggling household finances. Whether you're running a business or a family or both, Prudential can help you achieve financial wellness. Learn how at prudential.com/takeiton. Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am so excited to have one of LA's most beloved entrepreneurs in the studio with me, Sarah Gibson Tuttle, the founder and CEO of the incredible nail salons Olive and June. For those of you who might not know, Olive and June is essentially the dry bar of the mani-pedi experience, offering quality but affordable services in a gorgeous environment. Sarah started with one shop in Beverly Hills and has now since expanded to Pasadena and Santa Monica with more salons to come, not to mention her own line of sandals, as well as nail art stickers that are based on the salon's top designs. Plus, I have a hunch that there's more product to come, and hopefully Sarah's going to give us the inside scoop on that as well. And of course, since this is Second Life, you know that Sarah didn't start out in the beauty industry. Quite the opposite. She actually spent 10 years in New York's finance world, working as an equity sales trader for JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley before moving to LA and starting her own company. I am so thrilled she's sitting down with me to share her story. Now, on Second Life, it's Sarah Gibson Tuttle. Sarah, let's go back to the beginning. What did you study in school, and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I think I had a lot of different thoughts about what I was going to be when I grew up, and it changed over time. But in college, I was a philosophy major.
Really?
Yes.
And what does that mean exactly?
It means I like to think. I loved philosophy. I love being pushed to critically think. You know, philosophy is like just can be so esoteric that you have to think of a bunch of different outcomes, and there's no real – when you turn in a paper, like your professor isn't saying to you this is right or wrong. And there's a lot, I mean, obviously is boundaries, but you're able to kind of explore that and feel like if you've been thoughtful in your process, then you're rewarded for that. And I think I really gravitated towards that. And I, for like a hot second, thought I wanted to be a lawyer. And so philosophy is a major for someone who wants to be a lawyer.
I didn't realize that. I felt like everyone was like political science into it. But that's a really, that's interesting to know. So you thought maybe law, and then what happened?
So my aunt worked at People magazine. And before I went to college, before I went to Colgate, they were just launching Teen People. And her like best friend had was running Teen People, and he needed someone to basically, you know, be his lackey, essentially his intern. And she said intern, but really it was, can you just do everything around the office? And I was going to high school in Colorado at the time and jumped at it and said, I'll do anything. And so when I worked for Teen People, I worked there for 2 summers. And as I like leaned into philosophy but then worked there, I think what I realized was that I wasn't totally cut out for an office life. And so because it was advertising sales and it was much more businessy than I think I saw myself. But I loved the hustle and the pace. And so then I worked on the floor of the stock exchange for 2 summers because—
Well, that's different.
Totally. So my father worked in finance. And so I asked if there was any positions available, and basically being a runner on the floor was available. And so I went and worked for these brokers, and it was fantastic. I mean, I felt like this is with the center of everything.
Interesting. So you graduate from college. And what was your first job?
So I was an equity sales trader at JP Morgan.
How did you get that job? What does that exactly mean? What were your responsibilities? And tell me everything.
It's so interesting. Depending on who listens to this podcast, it'll be great advice. When I worked in college, I worked at Career Services. And the reason I worked at Career Services is because all the jobs flowed through Career Services. And I felt like, first of all, I just loved the atmosphere. I loved the people, the counselors, but also I needed a job. And I thought that I can work on my resume and I can see what jobs are coming through here.
So crafty. You're like, I'm just going to stand here and be the first in line to grab the good stuff.
Totally. And it was just more so like putting your resume in first. It wasn't like, but I felt like I was at the pulse. I was at the center of the pulse. And so, and I loved helping other people with their resumes. So I started doing these interviews and putting my resume in. And what I realized was why they would interview certain people. And then I could lean into that based on my classes that I was taking, and my GPA was not great, so I had to lean into anything that was possible. And so I got a bunch of interviews. I bombed a bunch of them because I didn't have an economics major. I didn't have a super strong GPA, but the last two interviews were Citigroup at the time and JP Morgan. And in my JP Morgan interview, I met one of my mentors who I basically just was like, I think I really talked about my raw passion and how much of hustle I have and what I wanted to do. And that I think he looked at me and said, this person, if put to anything, can figure it out and I can help mold and develop her. And so he gave me the job. And I think no one was more surprised than me.
Really? So what sort of thing, what does an equities trader?
Sales trader.
Equity sales trader do?
So basically, so equities means stocks and fixed income means bonds. And so I worked in the stock market, and basically you sit on a trading desk. Like you think of like any of those, you know, Wall Street, any of those
yes.
movies, and you're sitting on a trading desk where you're basically like one after another sitting on a desk, and you cover clients, so hedge funds, mutual funds, and essentially you're the liaison between the fund and the trader on your desk. And so when they come in and they want to buy or sell 100,000 shares of Citi, you're the caretaker for that order. And so, and it's obviously there's more to it than that. There's a lot of information flow. There's a lot of advice. There's IPOs, like there's other pieces to it, but essentially you're the caretaker for that order. It's sales and watching the market and knowing, okay, this is the right price, the wrong price that we bought or sold it at.
Got it. So did you feel equipped? Did you love it? Was it difficult?
I was totally not equipped, but I don't know that you can learn that in college. Like it's a job that with raw material, you can be molded towards. I'm not super analytical, and I hate saying like I'm not a numbers person because I think that in this world you have to be a numbers person, but I wouldn't say that I use a calculator, but I like care so much about clients and client service and making people happy and being really good at my job and the craft of that. Mm-hmm. And so I just basically asked a zillion questions and leaned in, and I was like so moldable, but I loved it. I mean, I love the pace of the floor of the stock exchange. I love the pace of a trading desk. I'm very, very type A and very New York and very fast, and I really vibe off of that.
So I can only imagine that had to have been relatively lucrative too. Was that part of why you wanted to go into it, or was that just a side benefit?
I've never gone into anything thinking I'm doing this for money, but I will say that I was on my own after college. I paid for part of my college. My parents are really strict, and they were like, we can afford a certain amount of your college tuition and the rest is on you. I chose to go to Colgate over state school, and my father's pretty straight up about what that meant and that I would have to pay for part of it, which is tough. So I think that it was great that I came out and I was able to honestly pay my father back in the first few years after college.
That's incredible.
Yeah. It was a great lesson. It stunk at the time, but it was a great lesson.
But to be able to be financially independent at 22 is an incredible, incredible feeling.
Yes, 100%. And I think I got to a point where I was not interested in doing it anymore. But until I had the next thing, I knew I was accruing savings, and that was something that was super attractive to me. But I had no choice. I was on my own one way or the other, and I was a theater minor, and I told my father I wanted to be an actress, and he was very honest with what that picture would look like, and I didn't do it. So, I mean, I had realities. Mm-hmm. I grew up in some pretty nice towns, but my parents were not, you know, we were just getting there, and they were very honest about what that looked like.
I also think that's a real gift, too, because I think so often parents try and shelter their children from the reality of the situation. And the unfortunate fact of that is then you're on your own and you don't have any sense of what it actually takes to get to where you need to go. I mean, I went to college. I didn't know how to write a check. Even though I had been working since I was 15, I didn't have any sense of how to budget or what things cost or anything. And I think being able to have some financial literacy and to be financially fluent at a young age is really important, and especially for women. So what were some of the big takeaways from that first job and that company?
A couple of things. I grew up on the trading desk. I think I was super immature walking in there. I think I had a lot of ego. You get this great job. And I got that job December of my senior year. So, So the second semester, I was like riding very high. You walk in and you're knocked down pretty quickly, and you do not know what you're doing. And I mean, I think I cried the first time someone quit because I didn't understand that people quit. I mean, I was pretty immature as to like what business look like. The key takeaways from both of my mentors in finance are from that JP Morgan stint, and I speak to both of them still, and they were so heavy on client service. I like distinctly remember all of the times that it was all about the client and all about making the client happy and that relationship and bending to the client and understanding when not to get taken advantage of, but basically how to navigate all those conversations. And so I think I worked on the service side of my talent level at that point.
That's what you leaned into. Okay.
Yeah.
So you moved on to Morgan Stanley and you were there for 7 years. What made you think, okay, now is the time for me to make that leap? And how did you know it was time to move on after a decade in the industry?
One of the reasons I left, candidly, is because, well, first of all, Morgan Stanley was like number one in equities, and JP Morgan, I think at the time, was 7 or 8. And so it was a huge level up for me. And I knew I'd be once again throwing myself into the deep end with much people that are much smarter than me. And I enjoy that. I've always enjoyed that because
you like a challenge.
I do. And I love self-improvement. I also had, candidly, at JP Morgan, not worked on the internal aspect of my career. I had really leaned into clients, and I learned pretty quickly that you can alienate people internally if all you're worried about is your clients. And so I say often to my team now, you have an internal client and an external client, and you have to make both people happy. I will say that I've always leaned into clients, and I still do it a little bit. I still find myself doing it. And our COO was like, an internal client, but it's something that I think I did the worst job of at JP Morgan. And so there was a moment where I didn't have as much internal support as I probably would have, but that's something that I leaned into pretty heavily at Morgan Stanley of like, how do you work with the team? Like, if I make the hedge fund happy, but I piss off the trader, that doesn't work. And how do I develop both sides of the relationship? Especially like, you know, just I look at the people who worked around me, and they were so talented and smart. And I think that when I came back and said, well, the client thinks this, they don't feel valued. And that doesn't feel good. And frankly, I didn't know what I was talking about. I mean, you know, I feel pretty passionately about making sure that both sides of that equation feel really good. And you're going to make people mad sometimes or frustrated or feel like you're wrong, but you have to even it out. Versus always being, I mean, I remember in one of my reviews, actually many of my reviews, they said, you wear the jersey of your client. You and your client are wearing the same jersey, and that's not going to work. And at some point they said, you can't be a managing director here until you actually want to lean in not only to the fundamentals of the market, but also you want to lean into the internal team. And there was moments there where I thought, I'm never going to be as internally focused as they want to be because I'm just so heavy on client. And probably about, you asked the question about when I was ready to move on, like 7 years in, 8 years in, I thought, I do not care if the market goes up or down. I only make clients happy. Secondary, I make people internally happy. We go out, we have fun. But like, this is not my passion.
Got it.
And I have all this client service inside of me, and I need to be doing something else with it.
So would you recommend to entrepreneurs who are out there or thinking about maybe their first step along that path, would you recommend working in finance?
I think that the thing about finance is that it's a boot camp. I mean, there is no – I've never seen a group of people that work harder. I mean, but I've also –
like, what were your hours like?
They were insane. I mean, we were in by 7, and if it was 7:05, everyone on the desk was looking at you, and you were there at least till 6, and then you were probably going out with your clients. So you're working on, like, 5 hours of sleep all the time. And if there's IPOs, I mean, I don't know what it's like now, but for those 10 years, it was
pressure cooker.
And I think anyone, whether it be you're a banking analyst, like it's just all of finance is working at a certain level and they're getting compensated for it. That for me, it was great boot camp and a great education. You grow up, you have to become professional. You have to become become the best version of yourself, or you're let go.
Got it. Okay. So you came to the awareness and the realization that this is not your passion, but you still are passionate about work. What was the final straw, or how did you know it was time to make that leap?
The last couple of years I worked on commission, so I really was able to see every month what I was taking home. And I had a couple of really good clients that took really good care of me in those years. And I was able to have enough financial security that I thought, I have enough to leave. Like, if I need to leave, I can. I don't know that's ever enough. I think you're always kind of scared. And my bank account now is scary in comparison, because it's all in the business. But I had enough. And it had been 10 years and I really wanted to move to LA. I started dating my now husband. I basically had already decided in my mind. And then it was about finding the perfect job.
Got it. So what did you decide to do?
Well, at first, similarly to not knowing what I wanted to do when I grew up, I thought I would be a talent manager because I love people. I love making them happy. I've worked with a lot of different types of personalities, and I thought this would be great because I could produce at some point. So I was thinking about it from a business perspective. It's also the biggest business in LA. And I met my now husband, who is an agent, and he quickly dissuaded me of doing said job. I think also he felt like I'd done something for a decade and that I wouldn't want to be an assistant for 3 years. He was probably right. But I interviewed, and then I basically, every time I interviewed, I got my hair blown at a dry bar. And I would go to like Earth Cafe and get my oatmeal. And I basically would, if you connect the dots of all the places that I went before and after these interviews, basically it was everything in the affordable luxury space. Like, I literally had made my life in LA in this kind of band of businesses. And I would get my nails done before the interviews, and the place would be very not on this level of what I believed it should be. And I would ask women, where do you get your nails done? You know, I love nails. Nails was always my favorite thing. And there was a moment where I thought, oh, I should do the affordable luxury nail salon. Like, this just makes sense. And so it was like a light bulb moment for me.
So you had moved to LA at this point?
I had not yet.
Okay, so you are still in New York.
I'm still at Morgan Stanley.
You're still working?
Yes.
Okay.
I have the idea. And then I basically had tried to get laid off at Morgan Stanley, which it's like, can I say this? They like would not lay me off. They were like, no, there's no like grounds to lay you off. So I was trying to get severance, and that didn't happen. So then I quit, and I worked for my father as a consultant for 6 months because he had just opened a commodities firm and he needed some help on the. And a couple of things happened. Basically, a client got fired that I was covering, and I said, I'm out. Like, I have this idea. Here's the Forbes article on Drybar. This woman seems to have figured out affordable luxury in scale. I'm going to do a chain of nail salons. For a week, he tried to convince me that I was crazy. And I had been going back and forth. And I was like, I'm doing it. And I literally like did a one-way ticket and left. And then I took probably 11 months. And then I opened Olive in June.
Okay. So so you decide you're going to make this big leap. You move to LA. Did you start a business plan? Did you have a vision of what it would look like? Did you have the name? What was your initial concept, and how long, I mean, you say 11 months to get everything together, but walk me through those 11 months.
All I knew was I wanted to do the dry bar for nails. Mm-hmm. All I knew that Allie Webb was the coolest person I had ever read about and thought she was amazing. And to think that she's now like my best friend is the weirdest thing ever. I was like a fangirl. I'm that girl. So I knew what I wanted to do. I knew the concept, and that was basically it. But like, I had no friends here. I had my husband. He was my boyfriend at the time. We didn't live together. I mean, he was like adamant that I get my own place and like be independent. I had three friends, and I had a bunch of girls who knew him that I think were super skeptical of who this girl was that was moving across the country with basically no business plan or idea. And I started meeting people and started like, you know, just chatting with like friends of friends, and we'd go to parties. And what I did is I got my nails done like 2 times a week. They were dead. My nails were like falling off by the time we opened. And I went to a bunch of trade shows. I went to a trade show in Ohio. And Elizabeth Holmes was writing for the Wall Street Journal at the time.
My friend.
Yes.
Yes.
Fantastic. She wrote that big nails piece in 2012 that was like on the cover of Personal Journal. That was the week that I went to the trade show in Ohio. And I thought, I am hitting it. Like, yeah. I get it. And
so what did you do at the Ohio trade show? What does one do at said trade show?
You're supposed to have a salon, like own a salon, and then be buying product for said salon.
Like pedicure stations or nail files?
All of those things.
Like, does OPI set up there?
Yes, everything. And it's a vendor. It's a vendor trade show. And so I did that. And then I started looking at real estate. I met a woman who owns a spa in Marin County. And like, so then she mentored me a little bit. I basically hired her to mentor me. I needed to learn everything about the market. I am definitely someone who jumps in and tries to learn everything. And so I thought I should just go. And then I went to probably 6 other trade shows.
So location, I feel like, is of paramount importance with any new business, but especially with nails. So how did you figure out where you were going to start?
So I mean, that's probably how I like fell in love with LA. I mean, I knew I loved it, but I really got to learn it because I basically went to every neighborhood and I hired a lawyer and she had a friend who had a license that worked in like bigger deals in real estate. And she was probably the only one who would talk to me because I'm not going to call out any brokers on here, but they did not want to talk to someone who had never opened a business. Landlords didn't want to talk to me. Brokers didn't want to talk to you. Like, and I didn't have millions of dollars.
Ew, you like got iced out. You were like, no offense by this, but because I mean this lovingly, but you're a little bit like Julia Roberts going in with the money and you're like, I want to buy something.
1,000%.
Big mistake. Huge.
100%. Like the brokers don't believe that you're actually going to pull the trigger. I mean, it's a lot of money. And the landlords want guarantees of literally, I think one space I wanted $1 million in cash, which clearly I didn't have. And I thought, this is crazy. How does anyone start a small business? How do you?
Not to mention that commercial leases, you have to personally guarantee, and many of them are for 10 years. And that's why Catherine and I ended up working out of her place and my place for so long, because it was so desperately scary to consider the reality of those commercial leases just for office space. I can't even imagine it's even more so for a consumer-facing business.
100%. I mean, all the fees, like going through the city, like the whole thing, it's like permitting, like they put so much cost, it's highly prohibitive, which is a bummer, which is
why. It's like they don't want you to make it.
No, and then you see some businesses that are super funded by really wealthy people and you're like, this isn't even a business the consumer wants. It's just someone who has money, and that's super disappointing. So yeah, that was pretty frustrating. But I mean, I was like a dog with a bone. Like there was no one that was going to stop me.
So did you think it was always Beverly Hills? That was the first one, right?
That was the first one. We looked at West Hollywood pretty seriously. We also looked at Brentwood. We just didn't find the right spaces. They weren't – the thing about Beverly Hills where we're located is that there's tons of foot traffic. It's sandwiched between two fantastic restaurants, La Scala and Porta Villa, and they're constantly busy. And I knew there was foot traffic. There's parking across the street. And we had to pay a lump sum to get to take over the lease. I mean, it was not an inexpensive venture, but I just like the minute I was like, this feels right. And I don't know that Beverly Hills is like the coolest place on the planet, but I knew that it was like chic and it embodied, you know, something that I think affordable luxury salon should embody. And I felt like the locals would love it. And it was so central.
So did you fund it yourself? Did you do a friends and family round? How did you figure out that first initial chunk?
I funded it myself. I purposely didn't take money. I used all of my savings and, you know, and I worked the front desk for the first year to save money.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I mean, but like, how proud you must have been that you could afford to do that with money that you had made yourself.
Yeah, 1,000%. And I really wanted to prove the model before I rolled it out. I just was like, if I'm going to take, I'm much cheaper with other people's money. And I wanted to make sure that it worked and that I had a real system and a real model. And if it didn't work, then it was on me. And then I would just go get a job.
Reasonable. So what was the initial offering? How did you know you wanted it to look and feel the way that it does? The name, let's get into all of that. Because it's very specific and it has a very, you have a very different point of view.
So then it's named after my grandmother's. Olive is my great-grandmother. June is my grandmother. I wanted to name my daughters Olive and June. And my husband is superstitious and said he would never name children directly after people. And so when I knew that, it was kind of when we started doing the naming, I said, I wanted it to feel familial. It just was immediate. I was like, I can live with these names forever.
Yes.
They will be mine. And with the point of view, we went through 3 designers before we hired Brady Cunningham of 10 over 6. So our brand director, Crystal Mears, who launched Daily Candy here, has launched every brand. She is
It's the coolest human who knows everyone and everything.
She's a sparkle fairy.
She is wonderful.
Basically, like, she's my true North Star. Like, when we were doing the branding, I remember I basically had the Dry Bar logo. I mean, it's, like, embarrassing to admit, but it was, like, in orange. It was, like, basically their font. And I was like, this is my logo. And she looked at me and said, oh, this is nice. I don't know that this is strong enough for a national brand. Maybe we should work on it, when she really was, like, screaming on the inside. And, I was so uncreative at that point. I hadn't tapped into that side of my life at all. And the last time I'd been creative was philosophy. So she is so good at getting me to be, I think, the best, most creative version of myself. I really surround myself with people that are much smarter and more creative and better than I am in the categories of which we work together. So when I struggled through a few designers, and she said, I know these women who own 10 over 6 and they're fantastic. And then I met them, and Brady and I just fell in love. And again, someone who's super talented at something that I know nothing about. But we looked at it from a point of view of, how do you make it look like your chic best friend's house?
Ah, that's why it's so wonderful.
Yeah, but like with the familiarity of, like, all the services are named after my mom's family. So it feels warm, but it also feels very chic. Way chicker than I am, by the way, because Brady and Crystal are much cooler than I am. But also, then we looked at it like what colors make you feel like you just kind of walked into, like, a very soft palette, so that the color of your nail polish pops. And then with the logo, you will notice that, like, usually it's in a soft muted color, but that it's kind of block style. And Crystal was pretty adamant. She wrote the first ever article on Dry Bar. And she said to me, well, before I even met Allie, she said, Dry Bar is Allie and Olive and June has to be Sarah. And so what does that look like? And so for our logo, we did something pretty block style, because half of me is, like, I have a pretty, like, direct, high energy, strong energy. And the other half of me is, like, pretty girly. And so she was like, I want you to lean into that when you do your branding.
I love that. So how did you know it was going to be a thing? Like, what was opening day like? And what did you, I think about publicity and awareness is such a huge piece of any business, but especially your business. Was that part easy from the get-go? Take me back to some of the early days, day one.
I think you go in waves before you open, and definitely after you open. There was waves where I was like, this is it. This is going to be insane. And then there were days where I was basically like, this is the worst idea. And I've put all my money into this and it's terrible.
And nobody's going to come to my party.
No one. And 3 days into Olive and June being open, not to skip four, but 3 days in, I literally said to my husband, I'm on the roller coaster and I want to get off. And he was like, you can't get off. Like, you're strapped in, which is, like, a phrase we use a lot about many things. So when we opened, we had a bunch of things run, and we had done a couple of days of, like, press days. Crystal had a deep network here, and so she invited a bunch of people. She said, I can't be your publicist. I'm a writer still, and I don't want to do that, but I can introduce you, and then it's on you to make the relationships. And so we did, and we had a bunch of things run, and Instagram was just, like, starting to take off. And so because Islam is so beautiful, like, we didn't— it's so funny when you see these things are like, make it Instagrammable. That wasn't a thing then.
Right.
But it was Instagrammable, and it was so genuinely so that it just took off. And we had a couple, like, sixth, seventh grade girls come in and they posted, and so all their friends went nuts. I mean, it was just like, it was discovery, like, at its
real
finest.
Real word of mouth.
100% word of mouth. And we did these preference sheets. On the bottom, it was like, how'd you hear about Olive and June? And it was constantly Instagram. And so it made total sense. And there was some press in there, but it was a lot of Instagram. And then, I mean, it just took off. There was obviously moments of, like, up and down, and I had to learn how to be a leader, and I think that took a minute for me, for sure. I'm a pretty direct person, and I'm self-deprecating. I kind of do things that I think are more friendly sometimes, and sometimes they're way too strong, and I had to, like, learn the balance of that. And, you know, I think I told manicurist once, she could sleep at my house, and then I told someone else, like, what are you doing? How could you do that? I mean, I had to, like, learn how to be— I never managed anyone before.
Wait, really?
Ever. I mean, of course—
I didn't realize that you were just, like, a lone wolf in your previous career.
Oh, yeah. I had my accounts, and I had a boss, but I didn't have to manage anyone.
It's so hard.
It's so hard. And I don't think I'm a natural manager.
I don't know that anyone is.
Well, my CFO/CO Claire is a incredible manager. She can literally have a conversation with anyone about anything, and it feels good.
So what has been the hardest part about being a manager and a leader for you? Because I find that part so fascinating, because I always say, they don't make a class for that. I realize they have management classes. but I didn't know that in the beginning. And I would try and read books. And that always felt like there were books written by people who had never managed anyone. And it felt very disconnected. And I just had to sort of, to be frank, fumble my way into my own management style, which is sometimes very effective and sometimes not as effective. I wouldn't say that I'm the poster girl for management 101. But how did you figure out what your style was and how to do it?
I'm still figuring it out. I think that I like to surround myself with people, I know I've said this like a million times, but like who are better at their jobs than I would be at their jobs. I try to find people that care more about Olive and June than they care about the specific jobs that they're doing, because we're all going to sweep the floors at some point. And so you have to just care so much about Olive and June and like just propelling it forward. I used to get really personal with people and like want to have dinner with them and like call them all the time and talk all the time. And like, no one needs that much SGT in their life that it works with me. So I'm learning it. I don't think I'm perfect at it. I care more about the people who work with me than I care about like many people, most people in my life. And so it's a lot of that attention can be a lot. And so I try really hard to like understand the boundaries.
I remember, I think my husband pointed out at some point, he's like, they're laughing because you're the boss, not because you're that funny. And he said that with love. And he was right about some joke I made that I was like, thought was so funny. And it was, there are some of those aha moments when you realize, okay, like they feel compelled to listen to my silly story. Maybe I shouldn't put that on them and be respectful of their time. And that's always been hard because I'm a people person and I like connecting. But to figure out what that balance is of still having personal connections and being there for someone, but also being cognizant of the power dynamic and respectful of their time and not to make them feel like they have to listen to whatever it is if it's not actually moving the business forward or about work. It's a strange balance.
That's my answer. That's basically my answer. And there's just so much weight that comes with being the founder and the CEO. And the other thing I've really tried to do and lean into is not be so reactive. And I think that we lost a few great people by the fact that I was so reactive. If a client had a bad experience, I was immediately calling the manager, like within 5 minutes of getting the email and just, how could we do this? How could this happen? And I love that I'm such a perfectionist because I believe the business has been successful partially because of that. I don't take full credit, but I think it's like that is a driving force. But nothing's going to change if I wait until our catch-up later today or I send an email and, you know, the client is dealt with tomorrow morning. I might wish it happened in 5 minutes, but the quality of life that someone gets when you're not down their throat is so much more important.
Agreed. Okay, so back to the business. Yeah. So it opens. It catches fire. You're working the front desk every day?
Every day.
That's a lot.
It was crazy.
Did you enjoy having such a bird's eye view of everything that was going in? Did you need that for your own sense of control?
I don't think it – sure, yes. I wanted to be like, I don't need control. It's not true. Yes, I also think that I felt pretty strongly that if I didn't know how to do the job, how could I ask other people to do it? Mm. So I – until we got it right, I mean, I was doing the laundry for the salon at my house for like months. I think I did a few things that didn't really make sense, but I needed to know how to run it. I needed to know how to replicate it. And I think I feel a little less this way. I read a book, Essentialism, recently and like put a few things into perspective. But I think I have I think my parents kind of wrongly instilled in me that like a lot of work is the way that you have a work ethic. And I think that that's true, but I think sometimes you have to take a step back and think bigger picture. Like, I don't think they did it on purpose. I just think it was like how they learned. And now I look back and I think a little bit of time and space sometimes makes things better. Crystal really taught me that.
Got it. So what metric did you have in your head for knowing it was the right time to pull the trigger on salon number 2 and then 3?
I couldn't get anyone to let me sign a lease.
Even though you had a thriving, flourishing business.
Yeah, so I got really lucky on the first salon. This is going to sound crazy, but the landlord was the uncle of someone I had worked with at Morgan Stanley. Hmm. So I got really lucky that he didn't make me personally guarantee it. I hope he doesn't change his mind after this podcast. And so at some point, when I was looking, I hadn't raised the friends and family, so I didn't have any money. And so to open another one, I couldn't do it. I couldn't prove it out. And they were like, let me see your bank account. And I was like, that's not something I want you to show you because that's not going to make you have faith. So then I started raising money because I said, I can't.
But you felt confident then at that point.
It was a great business. We weren't making a crazy margin, but the top line was we pay our team a ton, and we've always have, and we always will. It's so important to have the right team and the right manicurists and the right front desk, and we consistently are always trying to work and make sure that we have the best people. And so, but the top line was good, and the demand was huge. I mean, we wait list every day, and then we tried to get a location, and we couldn't, and no one was really paying attention to me. And Allie from Dry Bar said, "Hey, I have this location in Pasadena. We have part of it is what we built out to be just like the salon, but it's a training center. In fact, we're starting to do training in every shop versus doing it all in Pasadena. This courtyard is blowing up. Are you interested? You could take it and you'll get below market rent." And so when we opened that location, it didn't feel like it was going to be the best location. And it's every month is better. And that courtyard is the cutest courtyard like in California.
It's adorable.
By the way, I just want to say that the day we opened Pasadena was the worst day of my Olive and June career. That team is now so strong. It's crazy. But we had just like kind of flooded it with very brand new manicurists. And I learned a very valuable lesson, which I don't think I need to detail. I think you can imagine what that looked like. But opening was so, I mean, Allie was there. She was like, "What is going on?" I was like, "I don't know. No one can do a manicure." It was insane. And we were running late. I mean, we flooded VIP appointments on, you know, you do these press days and we just flooded it on top of these manicures that most of which were new. And we learned such a valuable lesson. And so by the time we opened the third one, we didn't open it with the team that was going to be there. We opened it with like the OG Beverly Hills team. They got up running and then they slowly shepherded the new manicurist. And it's a fantastic location.
Got it. So wait, one thing that I think is really interesting about your company is that you transitioned your manicurist from freelancers to employees, which makes you a leader, not only in that industry, but like within the beauty industry as a whole. What prompted that change and what has the reaction been like from both your team and your customers?
You know, the state of California really is not that interested in people being freelancers, and they've made that way clear. I'm a very cautious person. Like when we had contractors, everyone had contracts, like everyone brought their own tools. Like I was really, they made their own schedules. But it got to a point where we were scaling getting big enough, and we had a few contractors that weren't happy about being contractors. And it just, there was a tipping point where we said, this isn't going to work. And so after a few of those conversations, we had to work diligently to get that. And it's a huge undertaking. And I'm thrilled we did it. We lost manicurists that wanted to be contractors still. And I get it. I mean, for tax reason alone, but also like they want to be able to make their own schedules. But it's very hard to run a business with no control over schedules. It's very hard to run a business where you can't really mandate things and you can't have training. And that was like the hardest thing. I was like, I can never hire someone that I have to train at all. If they want to train, they have to basically come in here for free and just work with my manicurist. And like, that feels terrible. But I also knew that my contractors were able to have, like they had benefits on their own and they were getting paid heavily. So, and they had some tax advantage. So in some ways it's more lucrative and they felt better about the fact that they were contractors. I mean, I couldn't stand that we didn't have workers' comp. I couldn't stand that we didn't have benefits, but they didn't care as much about that.
Interesting.
And so it's knowing your team and what they care about.
Right.
And just because I had come from being an employee and loved my healthcare, they had their own independent plans and they were able to write off their car. So like, there was like a different mentality. So it's been an interesting shift. We lost some manicurists. Some manicurists have really leaned in and love it and they feel so supported and that feels great. I truly believe it's the best way for them. I think just being protected by the state, like just the whole thing just makes sense to me. The clients, we added a surcharge and we actually very, very soon are going to actually just take the surcharge away and just raise our prices. I tried to be as upfront as possible as to what the costs were going. I was like, the surcharge is literally going for benefits. It's we don't take any of that. That did not feel good to our clients.
Interesting.
It was I thought
being transparent would be better in that sense.
Me too. It didn't land.
Well, you live and learn.
Yeah, and we're changing it. You know, I think we took a year and we thought if they stop complaining about it, like it'll be a flash in the pan. And in fact, we've only raised our prices one other time. And when we raised our prices, I think we had two complaints. And the surcharge has had a slew of complaints. So we're changing it.
Speaking of flexible, you also branched out into product last year with your nail art stickers, which are based on the most requested nail designs, right?
That's right.
So what made you think it was the right time to start product?
About a year and a half ago, I took a step back from the business because we were getting a ton of like calls from, you know, funders, VC, PE, franchisees, acquisition conversations, like all these kind of conversations of like, what are you gonna do with your brand?
That's sexy.
It was fun. But also I didn't know. And everyone kept saying, do products. And I'm like, what does that mean? Like a nail polish? That doesn't seem like that exciting. There's a lot of nail polishes in the market. And I took a step back and thought, what does this industry look like? Like, where is the hole in this market? And so what I learned is that women on the coast, LA, San Francisco, and New York, were participating in nails about 40 times a year on average. And women outside of the coast are participating 6 times a year on average. And so you have this huge surge of salons on the coast. And I think New York has the most nail salons
per capita anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's like they're more than Starbucks. But the rest of the country was really not there, you know, and there's pockets, but essentially most women were kind of participating 3 times on their own and 3 times in a salon. And that felt huge to me, that divide. And I thought to myself, why is that happening? And we leaned in and said, why aren't you participating? Why only 3 times on your own? Like, obviously they're trying. Why don't they consistent? Why doesn't that 3 times go to 30? And they said that the products are rough. We don't know how to paint with our non-dominant hand. You know, I don't know. There's no education. Basically, they were just like, we're being left to figure it out ourselves. And figuring out how to paint, especially with your non-dominant, is really hard. And so I thought, there's something here. And I looked at the market and 90% of the nail industry is in the salon. So what I realized and surmised was that pro products that are being made for manicurists with their dominant hand are then being sold to the consumer. And there's no consumer product in nails. The other thing is that nails is a $10 billion industry within a $90 billion beauty industry. So, and if only 10% of that is in at home, you've got a $1 billion industry in a 90, no one's paying attention to it, which totally makes sense. Like if I'm like, I'm from finance, like I wouldn't pay attention to that industry either. But given the instance level of 6 versus 40 times, it's clear that that 1 billion can be a much larger number and there's huge opportunity. So I said to the team, I said, we should teach everyone in the world how to paint their own nails. We should bring Olive and June to everyone. This, like, the way women feel when they walk out of the salon is exactly how they should feel at home. There's such a lasting tail effect of nails where you paint your nails and 4 days later, they still look good. Whereas hair, makeup, your massage, like, days later, it's gone. And also there's no routine. Like I just leaned into like both the salon client and the at-home client. I felt like we're being underserved. There's no routine. There's no education. There's no content. Like, what do we do? And so the first step was, okay, what can we get quick to market to see if people actually care about this market? I went to Hong Kong and I met a bunch of vendors and I did a trade show and I basically tried to figure out like who are polish vendors, who are sticker vendors, like what could I do? And I found an amazing manufacturer in Korea who hand paints stickers and safe adhesive, like everything, like I checked every box. And I started working with them and within 3 months, we brought stickers to market and we had 1 piece of press. We had Refinery 29 and just, it went nuts. And so it was fantastic. It was like, oh, we've hit a nerve. People want these at home and they're little decals. And you know, we're known for nail art. So it just made sense. And so then I thought, okay, we have something here. Now we need to fully work on a whole product line.
Which leads me to my next question. How much of the experience do you want to own? Are you going into polish? Is that like what's coming up?
We are. So
that is exciting. Yeah.
So I guess
you say it so casually. We are.
We are. I looked at it like, okay, I want to have a long-lasting formula. I want it to be as free as possible while being as effective as possible. Obviously, there's 3 free, 5 free, 10 free. Ours is 7 free, but it has to work. And with the bottle itself, I was like, we're going to need a pro version and a consumer version. The pro version's beautiful. And the brush is fantastic. It fans and like it makes it so that when you're polishing your nails, it's 1 to 3 swipes and your whole nail is covered. But most people, it's 1 to 2. It's wide. I want it to be so easy to use. And our manicurists are very vocal about what works and what doesn't. The other thing is, before I tell you more about the polish, I took off 2018 from salon manicures, and I've been doing my own manicure for a year. I basically took a step back and said, okay, if I'm going to develop these products, I have to learn how to do this.
Wow.
So the first few were abysmal. But what I learned is like, oh, it takes like 7 times to do your nails so you get comfortable. Polishing, I think, is the hardest, then cuticles, then shape. Like those, and that's kind of like the order of importance too. So we created this polish. It's a rounded bottle and there's an overcap. But then you pop off the overcap and you put on the poppy, which is a patented handle, and it stabilizes your hand when you're painting with not only your dominant but your non-dominant hand.
Wow.
So we, for the last year, have been working on systems, and we have lots of ideas that Poppy is just the start of, that basically was like, how do you stabilize your hand? In addition, when you're painting your nails yourself, one hand is wet when you're using the handle. So, like, it has to be wide enough so that you don't mess up your nails. So it was like stabilization and just, like, practicality.
Wow.
There was a moment where Crystal and I were sitting there, and we were, like, looking at the handle, and we were like, this is so great, and, like, what does this look like? And then all of a sudden, she was like, what if it's rubber? And I said, and it fits on top of every nail polish bottle. And we were like, oh, my God.
Ding, ding, ding.
And we got the patent, and we're super excited about it.
That is hugely exciting. How many colors?
Polish, 6. So it's easier to paint your nails with a neutral. So we launched with neutrals, and we will continue to launch. Everything will be very tonal. So if you come in the salon, you see our polish wall, and everything's in, like, a color family. Very similar here. Like, I think if we launched reds, it would be like a collection of
a
reds.
A suite. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Got
so,
it.
6 colors to start. They're named after all of the Olive and June besties, so women that have supported us forever, that we love so much, and that
have been advocates for the brand.
Absolutely.
So we talk a lot about how women who listen to this podcast are often really, they might love their jobs, they might be ready to make a change, they might know something else is out there, but they just haven't done the work to actually take that leap. What advice would you give someone who is on the cusp or who knows she wants to make a change but doesn't know quite how to start or what to do?
I think if you know you want to do it, it's time. I think when you don't know is when you should wait. So I knew I wanted to do it, and I was kind of like so over my job that I was ready. Because it's so hard that if you're even hesitant at all, I think it's too painful. I think it's too difficult. I think that you will at some point give up because it's just not worth it. Owning your own business is the hardest thing I've ever done, probably second to being a mother, but it's so hard. And I just don't, if you don't have like the so much passion for it, it's just, it's too hard. And I would say, you asked a question before that I didn't totally answer. I didn't have a business plan. I just went for it. I kind of had modeled it out a little, like I knew how many people might have to come in, which kept me up at night. But I think that you kind of just have to figure it out on your own. Like, you're not going to know every answer. And like, I mean, I didn't go to business school. Like, I didn't have any sort of preparation, but I was a philosophy major with a 3.1 from Colgate. Like, I just did it. And I think but I also think you have to have the drive and the hustle to do it. If you don't, it will be extremely hard to get it done.
That makes sense. So we also live in this Instagram pretty filter world. I like to talk about mistakes. So what is the biggest mistake that you've made? Because I always think people, as much as they love hearing about other people's victories, you can't really learn from someone else's win, but you can always learn from their screw up. So what's something that you did that was a mistake at some point in your career, and what did you learn from it?
I think the biggest mistake we made that we didn't launch nail products first. I think that I wasn't sure if we were going to have 100 salons, and so I went after sandals because that was the number one SKU in our salon, and I wanted to have something really cool, and I was so sick of flip-flops, and I just was like, I want something new and different. We learned a lot about margin, so I think that it was in some ways like a very important lesson. Beauty tea was a total mistake. Like, we drank tea in the salon. I wanted to give people a way to strengthen their nails. It felt too far. It's very hard to sell beauty tea online. So I think not leaning into nail products first, but I wasn't, in some ways, like, Crystal has taught me this. Like, I didn't know I wanted to democratize the salon manicure. I didn't know that I wanted to bring Olive and June to everyone because we have limited appointments and limited availability. And, like, there's just only so much of couture Olive and June. So all these things led me to that. Like, I think there were missteps. I mean, our consumer was like, where is your nail polish? What are you doing? Like, even with the nail stickers, they were like, they love them. And
yeah,
we were selling thousands a month, and it was great. But I think they were like, polish, where is it? It's the essential thing of what you do. But we were like leaning into the lifestyle.
You got to it on your own time.
Yeah, we figured it out.
So my last question is my favorite question, and it is this. Sarah, if you could go back in time and talk to your younger self, what advice would you give her?
I think I would really lean into, like we talked about in the management, I think I would really lean into learning how to manage better. I think that we lost some great people along the way because I just thought like, oh, I can speak to them like I speak to my friends or like I speak to the guys in the trading desk or et cetera, et cetera. And I think I would give myself advice to really work on my management style. I think that the way you make people want to stay at a company is that you really cultivate that culture. And I think I learned that, but it was, you know, not until a couple years in. The other thing I would say, and I always tell people this, is when I left finance, I worked on this Olive and June project for a year. I should have gone and worked at SoulCycle or Drybar. Like, I would have been so much faster along the curve if I had done that. I was nervous because I thought somehow, like, if Drybar found out that I, like, left, it would be
weird. You were, like, a spy?
Yeah, and exactly. And so I didn't. And I think I also had, like, a bit of an ego about it. I look back and think I must have. My mom said to me, you need to learn this type of customer service. You've done retail. You've done sales trading. You've done all these things. But, like, this is a fast-paced turn appointment. And I think SoulCycle would have been amazing because their customer service is just bananas. And so I would have done that for 6 months. It might have delayed me for 6 months, but I would have done that. I think I would have learned so much about a retail business that scaled at location. I think people often are like, I want to be the boss, or like, I want to be the founder. And it's like, the best way that you're a founder and boss is if you know exactly what you're doing in their shoes. And I think I probably could have shortened that time in front desk and let people own it and have ownership over the business if I had had outside experience.
That makes sense. Well, Sarah, thank you for being so candid, and thank you. Congratulations on the launch, because
so
I know
exciting.
It's going to be fabulous. And thank you for taking the time to come by.
Thank you for having me.
That was Olive and June founder and CEO, Sarah Gibson Tuttle. For more inspiring interviews with women like Sarah, head on over to secondlifepod.com. If you liked today's show, and I hope that you did, please don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. I read every single review. So please, please, please think about leaving us one and just know that I'm going to read it. So don't be too mean. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Twitter and Instagram, so come follow us, tag us, say hi, slide into our DMs. We are always around. We also always want to know who you'd like to hear from on this show, so send in your requests the old-fashioned way via email to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM me on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr, or you can DM at Second Life Pod. You have so many options. Just send us a message. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life. Thanks to Prudential for sponsoring today's episode and for taking a road trip around the country with financial expert Alexandra Drain. Prudential sent her to discover the challenges getting in the way of our financial wellness. She met women starting businesses while juggling household finances, moms trying to save for college and retirement, not to mention women who don't want to outlive their savings. Learn more at prudential.com/takeiton.